This is Central Time. Most of the world is open ocean, but less than 10% of it is officially protected. Now, after nearly two decades of negotiations, a new treaty sets out to change that with the ultimate goal of protecting 30% of the world's high seas by the year 2030. The United Nations High Seas Treaty would now need to be ratified by individual countries. We're talking about a new treaty to protect the ocean and the ecosystems that exist under the sea. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about conservation, not on land, but in the ocean, and about this new treaty, the impact it might have? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Allison Fleming researches ocean conservation as an associate scientist at the UW-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, and she's research faculty at the University of North Carolina Wilmington Department of Biology and Marine Biology. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. It's a delight to be here.
Let's talk about this basic idea of conservation in the ocean. You know, we think of national parks and wildlife refuges and things like that on the land. How common is it pre this treaty to have these out in the open ocean?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there are existing areas that are protected in the ocean. But what's really exciting about this treaty is that most of those protected areas that exist today lie within what are called parts of our exclusive economic zones. And that's just sort of the technical term for the waters that belong to each nation. So those are the waters that exist from our shores out to 200 nautical miles offshore. And what this treaty is doing is focusing on the high seas and establishing mechanisms and protocols for making protected areas in the high seas. And so the high seas are all of the oceans that are beyond those 200 nautical miles. And as you just said, that accounts for a huge part of our planet. 50% of the Earth's surface is high seas, and two-thirds of the ocean is high seas. And so ignoring this huge swath of the ocean is really preventing a lot of protection from happening. So by focusing now on these high seas, we can add a lot more marine protected areas into the fold.
Now, looking at it from the outside, an ocean might look like an ocean wherever you are on the high seas. Can you talk about maybe the variety of habitats we might encounter in, as you say, half of the planet's surface?
Yeah, it's interesting. You might think sort of ocean is ocean, but just like on land, the ocean is really diverse and really heterogeneous. So there's certain areas that are really productive. There's other areas that are less productive in terms of biological activity at the surface. And then similarly, opposite kinds of patterns can exist at the seafloor. So there's areas that are underwater volcanoes and mountain ranges, just like we have on land. And those areas might be less diverse in some ways for biological activity, but more rich with regards to minerals and other types of resources that are now especially becoming of real interest to humans, as we need more of these materials for batteries and electric cars and energy storage. One of the interesting things about this agreement, and we can talk about this a little bit more later if that's helpful, but was really thinking about actually the genetic resources that exist in the ocean. And those resources already today have led to things like medicines to treat cancer or pharmaceuticals more broadly. And so sort of these questions of how do we get there, who gets to make things from them, and who gets to benefit from the economies that really scale up from those inventions and resources from the sea.
We're talking about protecting areas of the open ocean. What are we protecting them from? What kind of human activities are we concerned about that can harm ecosystems or maybe even particular species in the ocean?
Yeah, so mostly I think when a lot of us think of the oceans, our first thought is really about fish. And that is, of course, probably our main extraction activity that we still use for the sea. But now we also have seabed mining. We're talking about carbon capture in the sea, different resources, figuring out biochemical properties and compounds that can come from the ocean. Also just in general shipping. something like about 90% of all of the goods that we use in our daily lives get to us from high seas shipping. So they're crossing oceans to get to us. And those ships make a big impact on the oceans. They obviously can pollute at times. They add a lot of noise to the ocean. They can injure or kill animals on their way. They can move invasive species. So there's so many different activities that we take on the ocean that can have an impact. And there had been previously no single treaty, no single mechanism to really look at this in a holistic way. There were already close to about 20 different agreements that did govern the high seas, but those were very specific, and they would usually be about a certain type of tuna in one area, or just seabed mining in one area. And this is the first time that there is now a treaty, an agreement globally that will have a really unified approach to evaluating the impact of any type of activity that's happening on the high seas, have a true environmental impact assessment for that, have a public engagement with that process, and then be able to have countries and different interest bodies and stakeholders either put up disagreements to that or support for that. And that will really make this whole process much more transparent and give law where there previously was no law.
We're talking to ocean scientist Allison Fleming from UW-Madison about the UN Treaty to Protect Ocean Habitats. It took 20 years of negotiation to pass. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We're talking to a marine conservation expert. What do you want to know about how things like pollution, maybe climate change, which we'll get into, can affect the oceans and the various species that live in them? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with UW-Madison ocean scientist Allison Fleming, looking at a new UN treaty to protect the open ocean. You can join in if you have a question about conservation and preservation of ocean habitat. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Allison, we're talking about protecting for certain kinds of activities in, you know, limited areas of the ocean. How about climate change, though? What kind of impact do you worry about there that isn't just localized in one spot?
Yeah, that's a great question. That is a big part of why so many people were celebrating the agreement on this treaty, which, as you said at the top of the segment, has been really 20 years in the making. And obviously, during that 20-year time span from the start of this conversation, the landscape of concern we have over climate change and our understanding of how climate change impacts the ocean, and also the role that the ocean has in mitigating the effects of climate change and being part of the solutions, that understanding has changed so much over those two decades. So one reason that this treaty is so important is because it will help us accomplish a different global goal that was agreed upon last year in 2022. A global agreement on a global biodiversity framework was agreed upon. And that was laying out a goal of protecting 30% of the land, oceans, and coastal ecosystems by 2030. And in order to do that for the ocean, almost every single exclusive economic zone or every single part of the water that belongs to individual countries would have had to be placed under protection. No fishing, no extraction, no activities anthropogenically allowed, and that was impossible. So this high seas treaty is allowing us to protect huge amounts of the high seas. And the high seas are so important for climate because the ocean really helps regulate the global climate in so many different ways. The ocean has absorbed already about 30% of the carbon dioxide released into the atmosphere. The ocean produces roughly half of the oxygen we all breathe every day. The ocean is important for absorbing heat as well and regulating our climate. We estimate that over 90% of the excess heat that's already been trapped by greenhouse gas emissions has been absorbed by the ocean. So we should all be thanking the oceans. And if we offer these additional protections now under the treaty, what it's really doing is kind of improving the overall health of the ocean. Same, just like we can think about our own health. Of course, we all want to do all the things right, right? Eat well, stay active, get good sleep, keep our blood pressure low, etc. If we can do some of those things for the ocean, it allows the ocean to continue to do those really important climate services that we just mentioned, like regulate heat and carbon dioxide.
Now, the climate change part of this gives part of the what's in it for us story here. Earlier, you also mentioned, Allison, the idea that, hey, the genetic diversity of the ocean, we are finding some uses, some things that help us humans as well. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So specifically within this treaty, these are referred to as marine genetic resources. And interestingly, from previous international laws, the resources of the ocean have already been established as common heritage of humankind. So for the global good. And yet to get to the high seas is obviously a very difficult thing. It's 200 miles past all of our shores. So most people will never go to the high seas. And it costs a lot of money. It takes special ships and equipment. And so 10 or fewer countries across the globe account for more than 70% of the fishing that happens in the high seas, and probably about 98% of the patents on genetic sequences in marine life. And those really have potential influences on economies, on medical discoveries, on health, on general biochemical pharmaceutical development. And we're still discovering so many potential resources that are there. If we don't have an agreement that says how those are governed and how they're shared and who benefits from them, it really comes down to a very inequitable approach of countries that have the resources and the ships today to go after those. And then there's no rules in place to say who gets to benefit from them, even though a lot of those findings are of worthwhile to humans around the world. And yet only a small share of countries around the world so far have been able to access them. So a big part of this treaty is actually really going back to those basics of what's in the ocean is for everybody, is a global good for humankind, and we need to treat it as such.
In just our last minute or so, Allison, part of your research involves cetacean ecology, which I think means things like dolphins and whales. What does this treaty potentially mean for the species you study?
Oh, that's a great question. So one of the previous international governance mechanisms for the global oceans that did already exist is something called the International Whaling Committee Commission. And so that's existed for decades. And it's one of the few international governing bodies that actually was focused on biodiversity and conservation. And what's exciting is that what this treaty will do is interact with those existing mechanisms by really requiring states to kind of set a higher bar. So previously, the International Whaling Commission would have looked at the numbers of whales in an area, but really not also considered how many fish were being taken out of there or how much seabed mining was happening. And now this treaty will look at all of those pieces in tandem to evaluate sort of in a space-based, place-based way, how healthy is that part of the ocean? Are we doing enough? And the governments now have to consider all of those requirements to meet this mandate.
Allison, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Allison Fleming, Associate Scientist of the UW-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and a research faculty at the University of North Carolina as well. She studies marine biology. She joined us for a look at a new United Nations treaty aimed at protecting ocean ecosystems. Coming up, it's Food Friday. Christopher Kimball brings us noodle dishes from around the world. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. From ramen to rigatoni, noodles are a huge part of food cultures from around the world. And our next guest has traveled the globe to help find some of the best recipes and shares them in a new cookbook. It's Food Friday, and we want to hear from you. What is your favorite noodle dish? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Christopher Kimball is with us from the kitchens of Milk Street. You can check out the radio version of Milk Street Sunday mornings at 10 here on the Ideas Network. I talked to Chris earlier this week about the new cookbook, Milk Street Noodles. Now, noodles, I see from your book, are in so many different cultures around the world. What makes them such a big part of so many different food traditions?
They're cheap. They're easy to make most of the time. And they're like, it's like rice or beans. It's a good base, right, for other flavors. It's a neutral starting point that's filling, inexpensive, and obviously people like noodles.
Now, that seems like the big challenge of doing a book like this. You know, people have done whole books on Italian pasta or noodles in Thailand or whatever. How did you narrow things down and fit all these different traditions into this book?
Well, we actually travel, my editor and I, in separate trips all the time. So the challenge is when you go somewhere else is to find recipes that are going to work here. And by work, I mean, you know, are you going to have to make substitutions? Are they the kinds of things that people want to eat here? So our selection criteria, our noodle dishes, we think are going to appeal to the market here. Because every culture has a different, you know, tastes and textures they prefer. And so we have to sort of sort that out. And it sounds easy to do, you know, but
not
actually,
to me.
Well, the easy part is the travel and the tasting. But I mean, if you take beef noodle soup from Taiwan, for example, which originally came from China, I think, you know, they have a lot of ingredients in there, three or four or five of them that you're just not going to find here. So, you know, how do you make that transition? So I don't want to say the best recipes, but certainly the most appealing and most adaptable recipes from around the world.
One that I like, that this comes from going to the source, I think of Alfredo, like a fettuccine Alfredo is something that's delicious, but you know, so heavy when I get it here. I often don't do it. I'm going to feel logy. Well, hold on. You went to Italy, and what did you bring back there that's going to change my mind about Alfredo?
But that's a good example. You know, there are two restaurants that are very famous in Rome that serve fettuccine Alfredo. They have movie star pictures up on the walls. I think one of them was started in the 40s, and then I think he sold, and then he started another restaurant. So there are two of them. But you're right, it's heavy. And it turns out that fettuccine Alfredo originally was a recipe a mother would make for a child that has a stomachache, right? And all it is usually fresh pasta. You could use dried, some butter. The cooking water from the pasta is used. The starchy cooking water is a binder, and freshly ground Parmesan. And so you put some butter in a bowl. You cook your pasta, put it in the bowl, toss it, add a half cup or a cup of pasta cooking water, toss that for a while, add Parmesan cheese in two or three increments and keep tossing and adding water. So it teaches you a few things. The simple recipes really are great. Pasta cooking water is really an important way to bind ingredients, especially if you use less water. And then three, it's the tossing that really does it. It really creates that emulsion between the fat and the water and the pasta. And you really toss it for 2 or 3 minutes. And you get this really silky sauce, but it's not like that really heavy, creamy
right.
dish you find in the restaurant.
And another point you make in this recipe is with so few ingredients, this is a good time to think about the quality of the ingredients. Can you talk about your preferred butter and Parmesan to go into this, yeah, really limited number of ingredients recipe for Alfredo?
Well, the higher fat butters, like the Irish butter, Kerrygold, et cetera, those make a big difference. Some of the American butters around 81% fat, butter fat, and some of these other ones, Kerrygold, 83, 84, 85. It doesn't sound like a big difference, but they really are very different in cooking. They're thicker, creamier, darker yellow. And in a dish like this where the butter is a key ingredient, I would always cook with a sort of European style butter. And in terms of the Parmesan, obviously it has to be the real deal. And you have to grind it. You're not going to buy it pre-ground because that's a key ingredient. But I think at this time, most home cooks probably buy the real thing. I grew up with the stuff in the green can, you know, which tasted like it was, you know, made somewhere in the FDR's second term. But It has almost no flavor. So yeah, good cheese, good butter, you know. And the other thing is cook your pasta, pound of pasta, in 2 quarts of water, not four. If you're going to use that pasta water to help bind the sauce. And the last thing is very often you cook pasta, a little undercook it, finish it with a sauce in a pot or a skillet. So you finish cooking the sauce with the tomato sauce or whatever, and the pasta will absorb some of that sauce. And again, use less water, and that water is going to be helpful in binding everything together.
We've got that fettuccine Alfredo recipe at WPR.org/foodfriday. It is Food Friday. We're talking to Christopher Kimball from Milk Street, talking about the new cookbook, Milk Street Noodles. And you can check out the radio version of Milk Street Sunday mornings at 10 here on the Ideas Network. Christopher, you talk in the book, you give recipes for making our own noodles from around the world, but your recipes, the rest of them, don't require those homemade noodles. When do you want to make your own versus dry or frozen is fine?
Well, most Italians, if you spend time in Italy, they use dried pasta a lot, and they also use canned tomatoes, you know. So, obviously, if you want a really great lasagna, you know, making your own sheets of pasta is great. I think fresh pasta is great when you want a very simple, like pesto on it or something like that, where you're not burying it in a sauce. I think also one of the things that I think people should try, and I did this with a cook out in LA a couple of years ago, is udon noodles. It's just wheat flour, salt, and water. It's very simple. And you put it in a double layer of plastic bags. You take your shoes off and you jump up and down on it for about 5 minutes. So that's how you knead the dough. And it's really easy to do. And then you cut it into, you know, to lengths, ribbons, and it is so good. I mean, it has a little springiness to it. So I think the homemade pasta, when you want that spring, you know, you want a little bit of chew to it, I think that's really worthwhile. Or you want just a very simple sauce, like a, you know, maybe a chili, olive oil, garlic sauce, or something very simple.
I want to talk about cooking methods in pasta. And just speaking from personal experience here, one of the first times I tried making, I think it might have been a glass noodle, but it was an Asian, very skinny noodle. The package did not have instructions in English on it. I cooked it like I was cooking, you know, spaghetti or other Italian pasta. I ended up with a pot of mush. Can you talk about some of the variety of cooking instructions we might face with different types of noodles from different cultures?
Yeah, the semolina, the durum wheat pastas from Italy, can take up to 10 minutes or more. We have some at home, which I just cooked some the other night. It was over 10 minutes. Fresh pasta is like 2 minutes. Udon, soba, et cetera, also are pretty quick, especially like a rice, you know, a rice noodle of some kind, a vermicelli, for example. That's going to cook almost instantly. And then you want to probably rinse that one off. You would never do that with an Italian pasta, but because there's so much starch there that's going to clump together. But those cook very, very quickly. Also, some, you know, a lot of cultures actually fry their pastas, like fideo, et cetera. So sometimes you can actually cook them in oil and saute them to get a very different texture. But most pastas outside of Italy, a large percentage of them are very quick cooking.
Another recipe I wanted to look at, and I understand this has been very popular with Milk Street fans, a pasta with fresh tomatoes, capers, and herbs. And in the book, you talk about it's sort of like doing a pesto, but deconstructing and not actually blending together the pesto ingredients. Can you tell us a little bit about that kind of recipe?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, let's talk about pesto. Everyone thinks pesto is pine nuts, basil, and parmesan. Well, that's one of like 3,000 pestos. It's, you know, why do the Italians cook with olive oil? Well, because they had olive trees in the backyard, right? So you can make a pesto from almost anything. Any or just you need an herb, you need some kind of a nut, and you need some kind of hard cheese. So you can deconstruct that by not making a pesto. You can have the herbs, the right, and other things. And there are pestos with red peppers, for example. That's in the northeast corner of what used to be Italy, is now Italy. They do that as well. So pesto is just three things. And so you can deconstruct it and not make a pesto out of it, but just cook it that way. But I think a pesto is the most useful recipe in the world, right? You get some parsley, you have some almonds. One of our favorite recipes here is a spaghetti al limone, which is from Amalfi. And of course, they have lots of lemons there. So they make, they use lemon zest and almonds to make a pesto. And it's just amazing.
Christopher, as we wrap up, we could, of course, make incredibly elaborate pasta dishes that take hours to make. But you also write in the book, in a way, it's like the ultimate home fast food. What is your favorite? I want to be eating in 20 minutes or 30 minutes, and I want to do it with noodles. What is your go-to for that kind of situation?
You know, the simplest thing is to take oil, good olive oil. I'd smash 3 or 4 cloves of garlic, remove the skin, put it in the oil and cook it kind of medium low to get the flavor out. Take the garlic cloves out and then toss the cooked pasta into the skillet with some chili flakes. You could also have put a couple anchovies into the oil before you started, but just olive oil, garlic, and chili flakes is probably the simplest thing in the world, and it's delicious.
Christopher, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That was Christopher Kimball of Milk Street talking about the new cookbook, Milk Street Noodles. Check out the radio version of Milk Street Sunday mornings at 10 here on the Ideas Network and find a fettuccine Alfredo recipe, a little lighter than you might be used to, that I'm used to, over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up, we'll get the latest on the debt ceiling after a Republican bill passed in the U.S. House.